with Adams and I and Abood. Let's call the Labor and Commerce meeting to order. Let the record show that Senator Fahrenkamp, Ewing, and Kelly are present. First order of business, Senate concurrent resolution, no number, suspending Uniform Rule 41B, 24C, and 35 of the Alaska State Legislature concerning House Bill 177. House Bill 177 was passed out of this committee earlier. It deals with a portion of the workman's compensation program. The portion of the program that it deals with was inserted into the workman's compensation bill that passed the Senate several weeks ago. So in essence, House Bill 177 is a dead bill. There's a possibility that the workers' compensation bill that passed the Senate is languishing in House committees and will not be able to get to the floor for a vote. It is one of the session priorities. So what the staff of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee has done is develop a composite bill based upon the Senate version of the workers' compensation bill. Added some additional work done by the House Labor and Commerce Committee and some additional work done by the House Judiciary Committee, and rolled all that into one bill that, while I hope it's not necessary, we might have to pass over to the House if in fact they can't get the original Senate version of the bill onto the floor for the vote. So I would ask the permission of the committee to introduce Senate concurrent resolution tomorrow, suspending, which in effect changes the title of that other bill. And then on Monday, I would ask the committee to adopt a committee substitute on House Bill 177, adding the composite workers' comp bill into that and sending them both on the Rules Committee. So does anybody object to the introduction of Senate concurrent resolution suspending the uniform rules dealing with workers' compensation? No objections? We'll do that tomorrow. HJR, committee substitute for HJR number 18, finance, proposing amendment to the Constitution of the United States relating to residents' preference. There's a zero fiscal note on it. We heard this bill on Monday. It's a companion bill to a bill that we have later today. We have it ready. We'll have later on. We're just going to do some cleanup work on the other bill and pass it out. Is there a motion on House Resolution Number 18?
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent that we pass our committee substitute for House Resolution 18.
Any objections? So then.
Mr. Chairman, sir.
Can I do this afternoon? I'll chat with you first. Senate CS for CS for House Bill Number 32, Labor and Commerce, an act establishing the Alaska Racing Commission and authorizing fair mutual waging at sanctioned events. Representative Parsons.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. After our last meeting, we have prepared a committee substitute which basically meets the needs as expressed by the committee. Basically, what we did is that the Racing Commission is now placed on the Department of Commerce instead of the Department of Revenue. We also increased the age from 18 to 21 for a person to be able to participate. The staff members of the commission have now been identified as exempt employees. We also corrected an oversight where the investigation of the race meet operators will also be required along with everything else. But probably most importantly, Mr. Chairman, we pulled out all references to the dog team racing from this bill. In relation to the concern that you expressed in relation to the federal excise tax, we did look that up. We have provided your staff with the information, which basically says that pari-mutuel wagering is exempt from the federal excise tax if it's carried on by or to a license from the state. So therefore, that would not be a concern here. So those are the changes which we made in the committee substitute.
Okay. Just a statement from myself. I think pari-mutuel wagering and horse racing is a large step in and of itself, and I would be even more nervous about dog racing at the same time. I would think that dog racing should probably travel through the legislature on its own merits and in its own vehicle.
Mr. Chairman, would you care for having a committee substitute before us?
Yes, if you would, Senator.
I would move and ask unanimous consent that Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill Number 32, Labor and Commerce, be before us for consideration.
Is there any objections? Okay, that was an adoption motion, I presume.
Yes.
Is there a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent that Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill Number 32, Labor and Commerce, be moved from the Commerce Committee with individual recommendations.
Is there any objections? So moved.
Thank you much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Senate CS for CS for House Bill Number 548, proposed CS by the Labor and Commerce Committee, an act relating to oil discharge contingency plan. John, you want to explain what we did?
After our meeting the other day, there's two areas of concern in here that in Section 1, down the language of 1, 2, 3, and 4, the other measures was an area of concern, so we have deleted that in this version because it was broad. The other change is down second to the last line there. It's in section 2. The original bill said, I think it said immediately, and we, because of the concern for that language, we used the same language that was used in paragraph 1 in the existing statute saying shortest feasible time. So we put those two changes in as a CS.
Hey, Senator Farenkamp, did you have an amendment for the committee substitute?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the department had asked that on line 18, after plan 2, that they take steps necessary to demonstrate the stability of care contingency plan, including, and then it goes on 1, 2, and 3.
Recommend the change?
The department. There may be someone here to speak to that.
Is somebody from the department that wanted to testify today?
Mr. Chairman, we propose this language in order to address the committee's concern that we not leave an open-ended phrase in there, such as other measures, which could apply very broadly if the department chose it to apply that way, but rather leave a little bit of flexibility in the statute through the language that Senator Farenkamp just read, so that the holder of the approved contingency plan could be required to take steps necessary to demonstrate its ability to carry out the contingency plan, including the three items that are retained by the committee. It was our understanding of the committee's intent that the open-endedness of the other measures provision was objectionable, and yet there was not an objection to leaving a little bit of flexibility in that we're not always able to proceed down to every detail what might be most appropriate. So we had proposed that to Senator Farenkamp's office, given that she had raised the greatest concern about the previous language.
Could you state your name and who you work for the record?
Yes, I'm sorry. My name is Amy Kyle. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Okay, Senator Farenkamp, did you want to
Mr. Chairman,
amend that?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the amendment and ask unanimous consent.
Any objections? So done. Is there a motion on the
CS? Mr. Chairman, there's no one else, I guess, that's coming forward here to testify. I would move an unanimous consent to move out the Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill 548.
We have to adopt it first.
I'm sorry. I'd move an unanimous consent that we adopt the Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill Number 548 at Labor and Commerce.
As amended, is there any objections? So done. Is there a motion on the CS? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move and ask unanimous consent to pass out the Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill Number 548, Labor and Commerce.
Any objections? Sit down.
I might add, I think that's a big improvement from the original bill.
We're going to take a brief at ease. Mike Davis here. Substitute for House Bill Number 299 Finance, an act relating to the conduct of games of chance and conducts of skill by municipalities and nonprofit organizations and regulation of operators and pool tabs. Do we have a sign-up sheet for this one? Stu Kettle.
Ginger can explain the bill for Dave.
Kettle? Oh, I'm sorry. Ginger, go ahead. Yes, we are. Well, yeah, they're listening in, but they're not on this bill.
I don't have to turn this on.
It's well. Better if you do.
Senator Kelly and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, for the record, my name is Ginger Bain. I'm the aide to the House Labor and Commerce Committee, the prime sponsors of House Bill 299. This is a long and complex bill. I'm not prepared, although I could if you want. I could go through the bill item by item. I don't think that's necessary at this point. I've prepared a sectional analysis of the current version of the bill that's before you. I'd be happy to explain in detail or answer any questions. We have a representative from the Department of Revenue. They're very much in support of this measure. I'd just like to explain that the reason that the House Labor and Commerce introduced House Bill 299 was on request from the Alaska Charitable Gaming Association and in conjunction with the Department of Revenue, and several years of attempts to work through this legislature a more reasonable and workable system of regulating charitable gaming in Alaska. At this point, charitable gaming is somewhere between a $50 and $150 million a year business. We're not really sure how much because of the problems with the regulations, the problems with reporting that currently exist. We do know that in many cases, the amount of money that is actually returned to charitable organizations from their gaming activities is painfully small, and in many cases, none at all. There are amazing abuses going on within the system. This bill is an attempt to try to get a handle on some of that. The bill, the key elements of the bill is that it changes the, under current law, the organization has to be in existence for 5 years in order to be eligible for a permit. This bill changes it to 3 years. The current law limits the total amount of gaming prizes that an organization can award to $200,000 a year. Many organizations go way over that mark. We have organizations that are in the $800,000 a year range, the million plus range. There is no penalty under current law for going over the amount. Charitable organizations pay a 1% tax on the their net proceeds to the department. This bill doesn't change that. This bill does raise the annual limit from $200,000. This is the amount for the annual limit on the prizes they're allowed to be awarded to $1 million on the request of many organizations across the state, particularly in rural areas. And it also, the other key element in the bill is that the bill regulates and licenses operators. And this is a controversial area of the bill. Operators are persons who operate charitable gaming permits on behalf of the charity, the organizations themselves. We have operators under current practice. We've had operators for many years. Operators are not legally recognized under the law. As a result of that, there's a way to be a legal operator currently. They simply can become a member of the organizations that they serve. They get themselves designated as a member in charge. There are some operators that are operating 30 permits, and they are a member in charge of each one of the organizations that they happen to be running a permit for. This bill recognizes operators. It requires that they be licensed. It requires that they be bonded, that they maintain insurance, that they have background checks, and that they do substantial reporting to their charities. The bill also establishes two criteria that are real important for operators. One is it requires that an operator has to return a minimum profit level of 15%. And that's just that they have to do at least that well or they'll get their license pulled. In addition to that, it also establishes a minimum amount of proceeds that the operator has to return to their charity. So for 6 years, we've had a measure similar to this one pending before this legislature, and for various reasons, it did not become law. In between the two-year sessions, the department has attempted to promulgate regulations to try to get a handle on the charitable gaming activities in Alaska. The regulations have been met with extreme controversy from the charities that they were aimed at because they're very difficult for charities to work with. But the department is limited in what they can do through regulation. They need statutory change, and they had been unable to get the statutory change they needed, so they attempted to do things by regulation that made it very cumbersome for both them and the charities. The charities would much prefer this kind of legislation than the kind of regulations the department is going to be forced to promulgate if we can't get a handle on it through statutory change. I'd be happy to answer any other questions, but I prefer to defer at this point to the Department of Revenue. Mr. Kettle is very familiar with the aspects of this bill.
Does it provide for any percentage of the revenue that has to be given back in prizes?
I don't understand.
No, not the percentage given to the charities, but the percentage of the total revenues that have to be given back in prizes to the people playing the game.
Under current law, there is no minimum anything required to go back to the charities. You understand, under current law, we don't recognize operators. But
that's not the question.
Well, my point is, in the bill that passed out earlier on parimutuel betting, something like 60% of the parimutuel pot has to go back to the pool that's split up amongst the winners. Is there any provision in here to protect the folks that are playing the game?
No. Under charitable gaming, and understand when I say charitable gaming, we're talking about religious, political, educational, and charitable groups. It's not just charities. Under current practice, there's a certain percentage. What we're talking about here is bingo games and pull tabs. All right, there are some lotteries that occur. Lotteries make up a very small amount of what's going on here. We're mostly talking about pull tabs and bingo. Under bingo, because of the nature of the way bingo is played, the information that we have is about 80% of bingo goes out in prizes. If you take $100 in a bingo game, $80 to $85 is going to go out in the prize. That's how it's set up. There's not a very high profit margin on playing bingo. There is a very high profit margin on playing pull tabs, and the profit margin is set by the box of pull tabs. You know the box of pull tabs, you know how many pull tabs are in there, you know how many winners are in there. So there's a much higher percentage there. There's nothing in this bill that requires that a certain percentage of the prizes go back to the charity.
Does the bill authorize lotteries also?
The bill does not authorize lotteries. The bill does, at the current version that's before you, because of changes that occurred in the House Finance Committee. Prior to the bill coming to the House Finance Committee, there was a provision in the bill that said that pull tabs cannot be sold in more than one location in one day. That doesn't speak directly to lotteries, but the effect of that would be to prohibit the kind of lotteries that we've seen here in the last couple years in Alaska. Because the lotteries that we see in Alaska provide an instant win. In other words, you buy what is in essence a pull tab that gives you an opportunity to have an instant winner. It also gives you an opportunity to put that in a pot and later be eligible for further prizes in the lottery system. All right, so that kind of lottery ticket is legally defined as a pull tab. So the fact that the bill prohibited the sale of pull tabs in more than one place at one time would prevent a lottery from occurring. That section was amended in the House Finance Committee version that's before you now. And basically the version says that if the pull tab entitles you to a further winning, then it is exempted from the section of the law that says you can't sell them in more than one place at one time. There's another provision in the current version of the bill before you that says that if you're going to operate a lottery like that, either a permittee or an operator, you have to post a $250,000 bond.
Now, let me give you a hypothetical. Most of the pull tabs in communities throughout Alaska, Geocatch, Grand Anchorage, Fairbanks, most of them are for local lotteries, the local charities, right?
As far as I know.
I mean, does anybody that's operating a pull tab box in Juneau give money to an Anchorage charity?
Senator Kelly, I'd really like to defer these kinds of questions to the Department of Revenue because I'm out of my league here. As far as I know, that doesn't occur.
But I think my point is that if you have a statewide pull tab lottery, you know, doesn't that essentially detract money from the local charity to one charity or two charities somewhere, whoever's got that deal? Senator Frankie?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that in the lottery that I'm familiar with, that though it's been done for one or two of the charities, that a percentage of that has to be distributed to other places, or is being distributed to other places. So even though people might play in a lottery, say from Fairbanks and in Anchorage or Ketchikan or wherever, that there is some of that pot that goes to other charities throughout the state.
Is that in statute or regulation anymore?
It's not in statute, it's not in regulation, nor is it prohibited through regulation or statute. A couple of lotteries that we see, the most recent one that was a consortium of several organizations that were working, combining their permits and working, I believe that it was being organized by someone out of Glen Allen, I'm not sure. That organization it didn't violate current regulations or the statutes, but again, those regulations and statutes are silent on that issue, and that whole organization of the lottery made a lot of people pretty uncomfortable because there was no mechanism in place to track what was going on.
Okay, thank you, Ginger. Any questions for the agenda? Okay, Steve Kettle?
Yeah. For the record, my name is Steve Kettle. I'm Director of the Income and Excise Audit Division for the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue supports CS for House Bill 299. It's long overdue to give the department the authority, the teeth in the statute, as well as the personnel to administer and enforce the gaming laws in this state. I think Ginger's given you a brief rundown of the provisions in the statute, and I'm available to answer any questions that you might have on either how gaming is presently being run in the state or how it might be run by the department under this bill.
Provision of reducing from 3 to 5 to 3 years for eligible organizations. What's the incentive for reducing it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Szymanski, it was not an amendment that the Department of Revenue opposed or supported. It was one that we really had no position on. I would think that the reason would be that at this point in time, charities are finding it very, very difficult to raise funds for their operations. Many of them have been subsidized by federal and state government subsidies and payments and transfer payments over the years, and they're finding those sources of funds drying up. A lot of charities are wanting to get into the gaming as a way of supplementing their revenues, but they're finding that 5 years is difficult for them to meet. We're also, under present statute, hamstringing our charities with a $200,000 prize limit. It's a prize limit that they can meet within 2 or 3 months of operation in a year. And so what they're having to do is form subsidiary organizations, such as the Women's Auxiliary, or the sons of the organization, in order to double or triple the amount of revenues that they can raise because of the prize limits. Now, that prize limit's taken care of in this bill, as is the 5-year wait before a charity can be permitted.
I don't know, but maybe the senator from Fairbanks can respond.
Senator, I know in instance in Fairbanks that I'm familiar with, the American Legion post split into two. There's the Dolvin H. Baker post, and then now we have the Huber post. Now, this is one organization originally, and it's grown its place and it's now kind of making it closer to the people that live in different areas. So they have been trying now. They're restricted under the 5-year limit, the same as the original post, and it's only those under certain circumstances that can get it within the 3 years. It's not everybody, right? Am I misunderstanding that? But anyway, we've been trying to get the new post able to get their license in less than 5 years.
But I think they can't underneath the current law.
No, they can't.
They cannot.
No, they can't.
Can't?
cannot, under current law. It's a 5-year wait.
Even if they're an Elks Club?
The Elks Club has charters for each local Elks Club, and each chartered Elk or American Legion group must have their own separate permit under present statute.
And they have to wait 5 years to be in existence.
That's right.
The other question was more related to the 15%. Was that gross or net?
It's both.
That'd be good.
What we do is we start with gross revenue, and we say that an operator first must clear 15% of gross revenues. That is 15% of gross, less prizes, less taxes. There's another 15% on top of that that must be distributed to the charity. That's called 15% of net. That's adjusted gross, less expenses to run the games. So, in essence, 15% of 15% must be distributed to the charities, or the operator is in jeopardy of losing their operator's permit.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Did the department have any recommended changes to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, no, we don't.
Okay. Thank you. Bob Thomas?
Chairman, committee members, my name is Bob Thomas. I'm director of the Alaska Lottery Coalition. The Alaska Lottery Coalition is a nonprofit corporation that supports legislation for a state-operated, government-controlled lottery. The coalition has a high degree of concern with House Bill 299 in its current form. Page 17, lines 23 through 25, would allow the operation of regional and statewide lotteries by charitable gaming permit holders or operators using those permits. This form of lottery is currently prohibited by Alaska Regulation 15 AAC 105210. Basically, our position is that experience in the U.S., Canada, and worldwide has shown that government-run lotteries are basically the only form of lottery that's capable of providing the security necessary for protecting the public's interest. This assurance is the reason that government-run lotteries have been receiving the popularity they have in the last decade, two decades. The lottery, government-run lottery business in the U.S. will peak $13 billion this year. The consensus of those familiar with public gaming, talking about lottery administrative personnel, the service industry for government-run lotteries, and policymakers in states that are operating lotteries, all seem to agree that non-government operated lotteries are in extreme conflict with the public's interest. The stage being set by a committee substitute for House Bill 299 Finance is very similar to that of the early 1800s when government permitted but not government operated lotteries were very, very common in the U.S. and Canada. By the mid-1850s, lotteries in Canada, in the U.S., both federally and state, had been totally banned. And the reason for this is that lotteries were being manipulated by those people operating them. Lotteries weren't revived again until about 1960. The first one in the U.S. was 1964 in New Hampshire. The reason that lotteries came back into acceptance by state governments in the U.S. and provincial governments in Canada was the advent of computer systems that guarantee security so that those folks who choose to play the game can be guaranteed that they have a chance of winning the prizes that are advertised within the game. Unfortunately, a statewide lottery has been permitted to operate in Alaska for about the last year. Again, that's been in conflict with Department of Revenue regulations. This lottery is operated by an individual from Fairbanks using a charitable gaming permit from the Glen Allen American Legion Post. This lottery offers absolutely no security to ensure that the players are protected from outright fraud or accidental omissions, eliminating them from the drawings they're promised to be a part of. Should committee substitute for House Bill 299 Finance become law. This type of lottery operation would become legal and very likely flourish throughout Alaska. We predict that it would only be a matter of time before the absence of security would result in some type of scam with somebody walking with money. When this happens, the charities lose. They lose credibility. They lose money. The public is cheated, and the resulting image of legitimate lotteries is tarnished. We urge consideration of an amendment to committee substitute for House Bill 299 Finance to include sunset language that would allow the current operator to continue his operation through July 1st of 1989. This would discourage additional similar lotteries from being implemented until the legislature has had an opportunity to consider the issue next year and will minimize the hardship on the current operator. The sunset amendment should delete language on page 17, lines 23 through 25, beginning with unless, a full tab series, and ending with four additional prizes. And it should also eliminate paragraph G on page 18, lines 17 through 23, again, after July 1st, 1989. Be happy to answer any questions.
Who's the individual in Fairbanks running a lottery?
I believe his last name is...
Ed Dilley.
And how was he allowed to do it?
I don't know.
It's a state, we've never passed a statewide lottery.
Well, I know, but that's...
Mr. Chairman, that's being done under the... It's a, called a pull-tab lottery. It's not...
See, it's not a lottery the way... That's the reason I was going to ask the next question. He explained the lottery that you call a lottery. It's really pull-tabs.
The technical definition of pull tabs, they are a lottery. You place a bet, you buy a number, you either scratch off the and reveal what you bought, you rip it open, reveal what you bought, you place beans on it on a bingo card to reveal what you've got. They're all technically lotteries.
Well, then would you do away just wonder if that's the case, if they're all technically lotteries, or is what you're suggesting that we do with all of this then?
No.
In 89?
Oh. No.
Well, then you're using two definitions.
Unfortunately, I use a different definition than I think the definition for lotteries in this bill uses. And the terms for this discussion for lotteries is probably more generally accepted as a regional or area-wide gaming activity where you buy a chance on a ticket and you wait a while and a drawing is made and winner is revealed and somebody wins. That is the term I think, or the definition that most people use when they're discussing lotteries. The current operation, you buy a pull tab, and if you win a certain series, from what I understand, on that pull tab, when you open it, you win a chance to go into the pot for the lottery, or for a drawing, which, again, is just a second step in the lottery procedure.
Is there anybody here that knows something about the statewide lottery we're talking about?
I do.
Okay, any other questions for Bob? Thank you, Bob. You, Larry? Larry Patrick Miller.
Larry Hackenmiller, 2712 Jester Street, Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm here representing the Interior Restaurant and Beverage Association, Fairbanks, the interior area, and the founder of Plum Local in the interior area. Before I make comment on the lottery, Plum Local is not an entity. It's just a campaign put on by the Beverage Association in the Fairbanks area, interior, Indiana, and trying to get down to Tope and so on, that sells pull tabs. Not lottery tickets, in beverage establishments, licensed beverage establishments. In the Plum Local area, and I've sent copies to all the legislators here regarding the activities of the Beverage Association. The reason why we call it Plum Local is the money stays right in the local community. It does not go anywhere else. If I found out that Montessori School, which is the group that I represent, I'm a Montessori dad, and the member in charge also of that group, if I found out they were buying paper at Costco's in Anchorage, I wouldn't sell their pull tabs. because the money came from the people of Fairbanks and they're spending it in the town of Fairbanks. The Plum Local program, 100% of the proceeds go to the nonprofit group. And there are no costs, no charges, and we even try to talk the bars and beverage establishments into furnishing the bank to start off with so the nonprofit group does not have to worry about coming up with a bunch of money to begin this. We recognize their need. When the economy went down the tube, the state was in a pinch there. A lot of these nonprofit groups needed money. I like the Montessori system. As a Montessori dad, I like the way they educated my children. I've got a kid 3 months old that's going to go through the system, so I hope it exists that long. And the intent was, it started at my location, was to give these people some money. And as a nonprofit group, you know, not to burden them with expenses and so on. And why it is that all the other beverage establishments involved in this program are doing the same thing, I don't know. None of them have kids in Montessori school. So, but they're all supporting their each individual nonprofit group. How they do it elsewhere in the state, I do not know. I designed the program under investigation of the nonprofit groups in the Fairbanks area, the Elks, Eagles, Bingo Parlors, and so on. There is no problems, but I did recognize the problems. House Bill 299 addresses those problems uniquely so to where I think there is going to be a positive reaction. We're going to eliminate some of the problems. The Plum Local program will not change as we are, in fact, members of the group, not operators. So we give them it ranges anywhere from 21 to 30% profit on the pull tab. So we're well over that. But House Bill 299 is the first positive step in controlling what's going on out there. Now, with regards to the pull tab percentages, the pull tabs that you can purchase right now have a percentage varying from as low as 16% up to 30%. And that means that if I have a case of 2,184 tickets that sell for a dollar a piece, the Montessori school will receive $344 profit, and you'll pay out over 1,800. Now, what sets the percentage is volume sales. If I had a ticket that paid out $100 and sold 4,000, they wouldn't sell. So you have a higher payout ratio. That's the problem we had with the $200,000 limit. Montessori last year made, in my location, $48,907 in 11 months, but they paid out almost $200,000, which is the limit. So we couldn't go over the limit, and that restricted them. Well, I did a 30-day support for MS in the Ugly Bartender Contest. My bartender was the ugliest, by the way. And we did.
If you won.
She did, not me. We beat everybody else by three times. She was three times uglier than anybody else. But we did $10,000. So my location did $60,000. And again, 100% of the proceeds went to that group. Those wouldn't have sold without having a high payout. And that's the reason why the limit is there. It's not doing any good. Again, I can't emphasize the importance of 299 with regards to attacking some of the problems I discovered when I researched the pull tab sales and so on. I didn't want a monkey on my back. I didn't want somebody saying I couldn't do this because I was taking a step. The Elks and Eagles, I call them animal clubs, they were doing it, and they were bars selling for a nonprofit group. I figured, well, I can support my nonprofit group as well. So we did this. It's working very good. We have problems like anybody else, administrative problems, but we found it's working. How they do it around the rest of the state, I don't know, but I know 299 will correct problems outside of Plum Local that we've recognized at the beginning of this program. And the $1 million limit is fantastic. I'm going to cut Montessori off because there's at least 20 nonprofit groups up there that need the money, and I'm going to say we're going to try to raise $55,000-some, and then we'll get somebody else and we'll bring you back the first of the year to try and cover as many as we can. But the whole emphasis, a nonprofit group is set up to make money, where they don't have to go to the legislators and say, well, we need more money. How do you know the needs of Fairbanks or Anchorage or so on? I mean, how do we know? If we don't need, Bob's here, I'm sorry, Bob, the Fairbanks Art Association, we're not going to support it. Okay? So the local needs are met here. They're recognized by the local people. The money doesn't go anywhere, which is the reason why I think, if nothing else, the money we're saving the state by not having them come down here and request all these funds for you would be enough to attach a fiscal note to existing regulations. You know, hoping that 299 will go with the fiscal note, if it doesn't, at least give revenue the money to enforce this, because it's making me look bad, too. If there are problems out there, I don't want to be with that monkey that says, there's something wrong here, you can't do it anymore, because Montessori needs the funding. With regard to the lottery, that was kind of a takeoff. Ed Diller was in the Greater Fairbanks Racing Association. He was selling pull tabs at one of the locations under the Plum Local program. He took off on that on his own and worked with Sally Smith and Kelsey Parsons at the time regarding this situation here. Now, it was under their guidance that the first lottery began. And this was strictly a Fairbanks lottery, but then they started selling tickets in Anchorage and so on. Now it's gotten to a point to where Ed Dilley, his brother, is now they're operating, again, the Greater Fairbanks Racing Association lottery. This is, I believe, the third one. The one from Glen Allen went through, and they just had another. The Eagles first in Fairbanks, then the Glen Allen American Legion, and now they're doing the Greater Fairbanks Racing Association. They're giving a $100,000 grand prize. This one they're having progressive. Every week, if they have enough ticket sales, they're giving out a $2,000 prize. And then there's instant winners similar to the pull tabs. Okay, and they're selling so many tickets. And it's picked up. It's rigged. Two girls from Ketchikan won both the last $100,000. We know this, okay? So we're all going to fight out of Ketchikan to buy our tickets. But it is working under existing law. 299 will help tighten up that with the operator clauses and so on. This bill really does have what it takes to close the door, if not lock it, on a lot of the problems that we experience right now. So, you know, I would recommend approval.
Let's get back to this Dilley operation again. They give a $100,000 prize, and they're working under third $100,000 prizes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but let's say the $100,000 prize they gave for the Glen Allen American Legion. How much did they sell to give that $100,000 prize? Did they sell $100,000 worth of tickets, $200,000, $300,000? How did they do that?
Okay, I believe they had to. They couldn't go over their $200,000 limit. As it exists in payouts, and they gave—I have to figure this out backwards. I believe they awarded $43,000 to 22 nonprofit groups, and that they range from Fairbanks nonprofit groups, Juneau, Anchorage. It was up to the Glen Allen group at that time, I believe, to award the presentations. And the Glen Allen group received, I believe, $50,000. I'm not too sure. As far as what the limits are, the limitations, how many tickets did they sell? I have no idea.
Does anybody know?
No.
Yes.
They indicated to the Department of Revenue that each lottery they were going to hold, they would sell 300,000 tickets, more or less, but approximately 300,000 tickets at $1 a piece. They would have $72,000 in instant win payouts, $100,000 grand prize, so they kept it under the $200,000 limit and allowed their members to continue playing bingo in the bingo halls for the remainder of that prize money. And the rest were eaten up in expenses except for the, I think it was $48,000 they pulled us, and was distributed to charities throughout the state.
So you don't, I mean, have you audited any of those?
We have not audited. We did, because this is the first group that has tried this mechanism for raising money. We asked them to send us a computer printout once a month to show us where they were on the first lottery. We were somewhat skeptical that they'd be able to sell the full 300,000 tickets in the 6 weeks or so that they were giving themselves. And I guess they showed us something. They were able to sell it within the time limit and gave away the prize. But we have not audited their book. We don't have the staff to do that.
Well, how much do they make out of it? I mean, after the prizes and the charitable contribution, how much do the operators make out of it? The expense column, I would imagine that a large amount of that is income for them.
The operators themselves are only allowed to pay themselves an hourly wage. I have seen their wage statements. They are not paying themselves an exorbitant salary. Ed Dilley, according to the record, and I think it's public information, paid himself $2,000 a month plus expenses for flying around. And it was a full-time job. I mean, he was spending 80 hours a week on the job trying to get this thing started. I don't know if he continues to pay himself that much, but he does have employees that sales outlets throughout the state, and he has contractors that are going up and signing up vendors to market their tickets. Nothing is paid to those vendors that are selling the tickets. We have conducted a telephone survey of many of the vendors that are selling the tickets on their behalf, and they're not taking the company action. They're donating their sales folks' time to push the tickets.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the example that you had, Steve. I am who's on the other end. Mr. Chairman, you mentioned the $300,000 in the pull tab situation, right? They sold 300?
300,000 tickets.
All right, 300,000 tickets. They had $72,000 that was paid out in prizes. They had another 100,000 paid out in prizes. Is that right?
That's right.
So that's 172,000. Then they paid $48,000 to the charity. That leaves a balance of $80,000. Where does the $80,000 go? I mean, the hourly wage obviously is incorporated in that, but certainly that couldn't all be hourly wage.
They're paying rent for office facilities in Fairbanks and Anchorage. I don't know if they've got a facility down in Ketchikan. I know they don't here in Juneau. Travel, because it's against federal law to mail these tickets to any of the outlets. So they're either paying courier to take the tickets throughout the state, or they do have representatives that fly the tickets out to some of the outlying communities. They do have employees that eat up some of that cost. The ticket costs themselves are $30,000 for, I think he purchased a million tickets for $30,000. That's very expensive, but that's the price for pull tabs out of wherever he got them back east. So it's not a cheap operation over here.
And how long has this been going on?
Well, the first lottery I'm aware of began in late November. They completed that lottery by mid-January. They had a second one completed just recently, or now on their third.
So theoretically, they've netted 160 grand and they're on their next 80. And we don't know if they pay any of these prices. We don't know if they paid these people, right?
No, they have paid.
Yeah, we know they paid them.
All right, we know they paid the winners.
Yeah.
They paid the winners, and we know that they paid the charities on the first lottery. I have not kept close track of them after the first one. I felt that they were a legitimate organization that were operating for the on the behalf of charities throughout the state, and we just don't have the manpower to stay on top of that particular permittee, and we've got 900 permittees in the state. That's where it is now.
But under the new legislation, they could raise that lottery to $1 million, correct?
That's correct. The one-time prize for each lottery that they run could be as much as $1 million. I think they'd have a tough time selling that many tickets and keeping up that kind of interest in the state.
So, here's an interesting question. So you have 300,000 tickets, all right? So you're distributing around the state, and lo and behold, this gal down in Ketchikan wins on ticket number 2,000. Do they tell the other 298,000 people the big one's already gone?
No, what happens is that once they've sold enough tickets to beat the $100,000 prize, they usually have a date on it. They draw one ticket out of the box when they've got all the tickets in there that have entry. See, some have instant winners, like a pull tab. You can win $50 instantly. Others have entry written on it. All the entry tickets go into one container, and then they have the drawing. They put it in a big container. They draw that one ticket out of there when all the entries are completed. Then they win the $100,000, and she receives a check immediately for that. And then the other funds, now I'm speaking secondhand here. Plum Local is not involved in this, and I'm for a lottery. I don't care if the state or operator runs it, but I think we can use this existing program, if there's faults with it, with 299 to figure out how to handle it, you know, no matter who can do it, the state or whatever. But the additional fund, it's strictly up to the guy who has a permit. If the American Legion now has a permit on this last one, then they're going to determine which groups they want to give the funding to. And I've seen $2,000 going out in different checks to...
Yeah, we've got a list here of who the American Legion said they either sent checks to or pledged checks to for about $49,000.
Yeah. And how the mechanics of it works after that, I'm not too sure. I do know that they get that $100,000 check right away. And everybody in Fairbanks is mad because two girls in Ketchikan won it, see? So that's a pretty popular thing. To go over or up to $1 million, I don't know if it would be feasible or not. It may. I know $100,000 is an attractive figure. They can turn it over and get different nonprofit groups involved. You're still circling that money. It may not go with the specific Glen Allen area in this case. Some of it may go to Fairbanks or Anchorage or Juneau, but there is still an outlet there where they can get funding, and it doesn't require you to have a permit. You know, if you're a fresh company, or it brings in general funding.
Let me go back to under the terms of the existing of the proposed legislation. Do you have any more authority to audit these people? Because this isn't going to be the only group doing it, right? If this bill passes, there's going to be these groups that are spinning up all over the state, and they're going to have $150,000 lotteries and $200,000 lotteries, and it's going to be Katie bar the door. How are you going to audit all of that? How are you going to keep track of all of that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've given it some thought, and I think you're presenting one of the difficult challenges this department will have. We'll at least have, if this fiscal notice accepted, we will have four audit-type individuals put in this department for the enforcement of all of the gaming, not just this particular lottery, but all of gaming. We will have a connection because we'll be able to require the manufacturer of the pull tab and the distributor of the pull tab to file a report with us. By regulation, we can require them to indicate to us how many pull tabs have been, or lottery tickets have been sold to a particular group that's running a statewide lottery. I think the controls are in place just in the reporting process, and it's an extensive reporting process. The operators are required to report to the charities. Both the charities and the operators and the distributors are required to report to the Department of Revenue, not just on an annual basis, but on a quarterly basis. So I think we have in the statute the outline for an acceptable reporting of information to the department upon which to audit.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to get that clarified. What are we talking about as far as, are you talking about there? All these things are going to spring up, all these mini lotteries are going to spring up all over the state, these pull tabs? Are you saying that they're restricted to the present operators that are there right now? I don't understand. What's going to happen there?
Present law and the new law does not discriminate in favor of this one lottery operator. Anyone could, and others are setting up little local lotteries, but even a pull tab instant win concept with a $10,000 grand prize. The problem with a statewide lottery of this nature is that it takes 6 to 8 weeks to sell 300,000 tickets. And I'm not in the practice of playing these games, but those who are want to win now. If you look at the state of Washington, they have $2 million prizes each week. And people will come back and plunk their money down at the end, at the beginning of each new lottery. Here, you put down your $1. You've got to wait 6 weeks to find out if you even won the $100,000. So it's difficult to keep your interest up in a particular lottery. You'll want to wait until the next one to put down the next dollar. The instant win on these tickets is somewhere around 15%, as opposed to, as Larry was telling you, 85% chance of winning, or at least 85% payout on regular pull tabs. So the odds on these tickets are very, very long. And so I think that the odds also of another lottery, statewide type lottery springing up, is very long. Local lotteries, I expect local charities to begin catching on. We've got one here in Juneau now, being run by the Sons of the Legionnaires, that has a $10,000 prize when they sell enough tickets with the instant win pull tab concept.
So, Mr. Chairman, what you're saying then is that with this bill, all these individual charitable organizations all over the state will be able to have their own.
They can now.
They can now.
Well, they can now.
Yes.
That's nothing to
that. Okay, so that's no different.
What this does, though, is, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, please.
What this does is to require bonding for those people who are in it and controls by the department. If this is not instigating a new lottery, what this is doing is giving the controls for handling the ones we have.
Well, but there's a policy call as to whether or not when we authorize poll tabs, we authorize these big statewide efforts. I mean, I never authorized that. I had no idea when that bill was going through. We were talking about $100,000 tickets to statewide efforts.
Were you here when that was right?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, one of the problems we have with the present
well,
statute.
Well, when did it go through? Yeah, I voted against it. I remember.
I remember.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things I should point out is that in present statute, the law authorizes pull tabs, and the law authorizes lotteries or. Raffles. But the law doesn't speak about a combo lottery raffle ticket or a pull tab raffle ticket. This new law says that pull tabs may only be sold in a single series of pull tabs, may only be sold in one place at one time. But it also allows for the sale of pull tabs that have this grand prize drawing to be sold throughout the state, rather than in one location at that time. It's important for at least for the sale of pull tabs to keep them all in one location for control purposes. But this bill also allows to expand on that for the lottery concept.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
The marketing constraints wouldn't be feasible. And there. As far as another statewide or 10 statewide lotteries at $1 apiece going for $100,000, you can only get them in so many quick stops. Okay, I don't sell the lottery tickets. I used to sell the lottery tickets, but right now I have a conflict. Okay, I would prefer to sell them to my Montessori group or the pull tab for my Montessori group, but I could sell the lottery tickets. It's just that there's no incentive for me to do it. My kids don't get educated with the American Legion. They get educated with the Montessori Association, so it's competing with that. In addition, your bigger sellers are your like Foodland and Gottstein's area that sell a lot of the lottery tickets. That's where your majority of the sales are, and they are certainly not going to have 15 different pull tabs. They got enough to do with their little machines getting the groceries out. So, as far as from a marketing point of view, I doubt you're going to see any more statewide if this continues, unless you have it set up like they do in most with the electronic lotteries, where you can punch the numbers and there it is, and it's all automatic, and that would be a state-run lottery.
You mean these lotteries are ran out of quick stops and grocery stores?
Mm-hmm. In your market basket grocery store, you could buy a lottery ticket at the register when you're checking out.
I have no idea. I've seen pull tabs. Well, where did we authorize that? Any other questions? Anybody else want to testify on this bill? Yes.
My name is Bob Houston. I'm the managing director for the Fairbanks Arts Association. Like, in contradiction to what Larry said, we do need additional funding sources, and House Bill 299 seems to give us those opportunities to raise our revenues that we generate. I think the proposed bill does address specific areas that are problem areas right now with the limits on the money that we could generate. It's my understanding that 20 years ago this bill was, or the law was enacted where it limited $200,000 in gross payouts. If you consider the inflation rate over the last 20 years, that's a negligible amount in this day. It also defines the operators and the operator status, and we're in agreement with that. And we would like to be able to see this bill enacted so that a number of arts organizations would be able to benefit from income that we can generate locally from not only our own local inhabitants, but from tourists that come to Fairbanks and are willing to purchase a pull tab to help support our local organizations.
Where do you sell your pull tabs?
Right now we have a bar selling them. It's called the Big Eye.
Any questions?
Okay. Anybody else want to testify on this bill? Are there any proposed amendments? I was under the impression we had one proposed amendment somewhere. Okay, we'll put this bill off until another meeting.
What's the amendment?
Okay, CS for House Bill number 459, Resources, an act relating to liability for release of hazardous substances. Is Anchorage on the line now?
We are.
Okay, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Davis, and I represent District 19. If you'd like, Mr. Chairman, I'll just make a few opening remarks on the legislation.
Yeah.
That meet with your approval. House Bill 459 strengthens and more clearly defines Alaska statutes in regard to liability for hazardous substance releases. The present statutes, in effect, do not clearly attach liability to anyone except the person who owns or operates the facility at the time of the hazardous substance release. If the release occurs after a site is abandoned or the contractor improperly handles or disposes of waste, the original owner or producer of the waste may escape liability. And how I came into a little knowledgeable on this subject, Mr. Chairman, is I was up on the North Slope, I believe it's been about a year ago now, and saw the child's site, and there should be an article in your packet related to the child site. And although it doesn't real closely parallel, but what happened there is basically somebody walked from, went bankrupt and walked, and the state was liable for the cleanup of that that site. And because we happened to have a congressional hearing that was involved ANWR, the oil industry decided to go ahead and clean it up, and I think they're actually, it's not totally cleaned up now, but anyway, that's, I was up there at the time of when they discovered this, did a little more research into the laws and found out what our strict liability laws have, or what is on the books and what's needed to be done. So with the drafting of this, it's actually the legislation does parallel federal statutes related to strict liability. And the other thing I found out was that we have 24 states that do have strict liability statutes. So it's not something that that the other states have ignored. And what this legislation would do would be to provide an incentive for businesses to properly dispose of waste or carefully choose facilities to handle transportation, handling, and disposal of the hazardous substance. Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to go into the actual part of the bill if you'd like and tell you about the changes of the bill. But basically, the major change is that it includes not only the owner of the substance, the operator of the facility, the original owner of the substance when the handling, transportation, and disposal was contracted out to another party, but also the transporter if the transporter selected a facility. And the reason that we include the last person in there is let's say you have someone that's a generator of a hazardous substance, and he gives it to a transporter, and it, and you don't know where it's going to go to, then that transporter would also would be the liable person because he would be selecting the facility. What's happened in Kenai and other places around the state is state and local governments are being faced with the cost of cleaning up hazardous substance because when they attach a liability to an owner of the substance, the owner says, I'm bankrupt, and he goes out of business. And this has happened a number of times, and this would certainly take care of a situation like that. I think with this legislation in place, we would not have some of these incidents that, like we did have at Childs, and you know, we wouldn't have to be concerned about congressional oversight and perhaps people that are speaking against things like ANWR, because you know, we'd be addressing a serious problem and making sure that the future ones don't take place. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to testify this afternoon and for your timely scheduling this bill, and I'd certainly be glad to answer any questions that you may have. But that concludes my testimony.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Faircamp?
I don't understand. Mike, on page, just page 1, line 26, the way the language is written there, that a vessel in whom the release occurred or was threatened to occur at the time.
Actually, I don't know if you have the current statutes, Senator Faircamp, but I think that actually is...
current statute?
That's current statutes now.
Well, I don't see any underlining or lining or any way to distinguish one from the other as far as this bill.
Yeah, Matt,
Senator, it's been repealed and rewritten.
It's yeah. So it's, but I believe I did include in your packet the original statutes.
Yeah, I got that.
Let me ask a question, Mike. Why didn't you simply amend the present bill? Repeal and rewrites always make, you know, read acts always make people really nervous. Is the present bill so different that you couldn't amend it?
I don't know if we, Mr. Hines is here, and Mr. Mertz, who has worked on the legislation, is here, and perhaps could address that, but it is an expansion of the liability statute, so I suppose we could have added to it, but maybe Mertz could frankly answer that better than I. Is that okay if you join me?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Douglas Mertz from the Department of Law. The reason it was done in the form of a repeal and reenactment rather than a straight amendment is that the straight amendment about 4/5 of the material would be new.
Okay, in a nutshell, what's the current liability statute?
The current liability statute is also strict liability. It says strict liability for all damages, including damages to natural resource, but it does not go into who is liable with the kind of detail here. Thus, it's possible for people who are not direct possessors or not the direct causers of the spill to escape liability right now.
Let me make a hypothetical. Then ARCO sells a barrel of lubricating oil to Northwest Energies Limited. They take it up the North Slope. They spill it. They go out of business. ARCO's liable?
No. ARCO would not be liable.
It says producer.
No, not producer. The person who owned it or controlled it at the time. Now, there is one provision here that does provide that kind of remote liability. That's when you're dealing with waste. Say ARCO produces a hazardous substance that no longer has a useful life, it isn't going to sell it as a retail product, it wants to get rid of it, and it gives it to somebody else to dispose of it, and that person causes a problem, then ARCO would be liable.
Mr. Chairman, I'll give you an example, and I can't, the name of the site doesn't, North Slope Salvage, I believe that's the name of it. North Slope Salvage is an example of I guess what we would call a fly-by-night outfit. They were acquired a whole series of substances of all kinds, stored it on a yard, and it was discovered that they were illegally storing those substances. There was a bankruptcy. They didn't have any money to clean up the site. What
what happened is they didn't use the strict liability statutes on that, but they used common law statutes, which also are in place. And the people that had to ultimately have to pay for that was the generators of those substances. And so this legislation would more clearly define our strict liability statutes. It doesn't mean that we don't have, we can't, and attorneys don't use common law. They also use common law in enforcing the provisions of dealing with when people are having some kind of a relationship with hazardous substances. And I can't speak to the common law statutes in practice. Mr. Mertz could if you would like. But what this does, as I said, is more clearly define what is the strict liability for dealing with these hazardous substances.
Okay. Is oil considered a hazardous substance? So what did I miss? If they send a barrel of oil up the North Slope to somebody, lubricating oil, and that person spills it, that's a hazardous substance, right?
You do not have liability for another person's misuse of a hazardous substance. If you sell it to him, normal retail trade, expect him to do whatever he intends to continue to use it, your liability is cut off. The only exception is if what you give him is waste material that won't have any future usefulness, and you intend that person to dispose of it, you're actually using them as disposal, then you're responsible for making sure that you're giving it to a responsible character. But other than that, you don't have continuous liability.
Okay. All right, any other questions?
Thank you.
Amy Kyle.
For the record, my name is Amy Kyle, and I'm representing the Department of Environmental Conservation. The department and the administration support this bill. This bill would codify the responsibility for hazardous substance spills, which is not now clear in the statute. The state has many sites where we have improperly disposed hazardous substances and waste, and we are increasingly having to deal with those and are learning more and more about what our statutes do and do not allow us to do. It's a national problem which has been addressed through means including the federal Superfund law, which sets a strict liability standard similar to the one proposed in this bill. It's very important to set the proper standards of liability and proper incentives for good waste disposal, simply because cleanup costs are very expensive, and the dangers posed by improperly disposed waste are considerable. Our experience even here in Alaska has shown that we have quite a few sites that do pose potential health problems or environmental problems and that need cleanup or access restrictions.
Okay, Amy, can I interrupt for a second? This committee is going to have to recess at 5 o'clock for 10 or 15 minutes, so what I'd like to do with your permission is interrupt your testimony, go to the teleconference site and pick up the folks that have been waiting there to testify, and we'll come back here because we can all get together again in this room. So
certainly, Mr.
Stay
Chairman.
There. And we'll switch to Anchorage then and listen for Stephanie Kessler.
Thank you. My name is Stephanie Kessler. Can you hear me all right there?
We can hear you.
Okay. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Center for the Environment. We are the lead state environmental organization working on hazardous waste and toxic issues. We spent considerable time working on the Kenai with problems there, both citizens and with the Kenai Borough. We're actively involved in Anchorage, especially monitoring a local site, Alaska Husky Battery, and do a lot of action statewide in monitoring cleanup programs. I can speak to the importance of this bill because that we work directly, for example, with one site that, as a result of the lack of strong liability language in state law, we are unable to find money for cleanup, and so it is left with the Kenai Borough to clean up. This is the Sterling Special Waste Site, and one of our staff persons sits on the Citizens Advisory Committee for that cleanup. This language is very important to make very clear the definition of the law of who is liable and to what degree. It defines that liability through the entire chain of custody to ensure that there are no loopholes in the case of a spill or mismanagement of hazardous waste. It is a preventive measure. I can't emphasize enough how important it is that we start preventing mismanagement of hazardous waste and spills, because cleanup costs are simply astronomical in comparison to what it would take to manage them correctly. And we hope it will act as a deterrent to contractors and industries and all those handling hazardous waste, that they must know that they are liable to do this professionally. I want to emphasize, too, that this will benefit industry. The case of the North Slope salvage was brought up. That was actually a contractor to, I think, the oil companies that mismanaged the waste. That person was not held financially responsible for the cleanup costs, which I think were in the realm of about $5 million, and I believe the oil companies ended up having to pay that bill. This kind of law would change that situation some. I want to just emphasize the cost that we're talking about that public dollars may have to bear. The Sterling Special Waste Site is going to cost about $1 million in the total bill, and these are public dollars that are ending up having to pay for these cleanups. So I strongly support this bill and its language. It is nothing controversial, and as you've heard, it already mirrors what is in federal law and in many other states dealing with hazardous waste problems. Thank you.
Thank you. Was Adrienne Anderson in Anchorage?
Yes.
Go ahead.
My name is Adrienne Anderson. I'm the Western Regional Director for the National Campaign Against Toxic Hazards based in Denver, Colorado. I'm here working with the Alaska Center for the Environment and also in support of the victims in the Kenai Borough situation, and here to strongly support the passage of 459 for strict liability and joint and several liability for toxics, because we feel that it's a very strong measure to protect public health and safety overall, and that it will also protect in the short and long range the economic development avenues for the state of Alaska, and also the economic diversification, protecting existing resources for tourism dollars and other types of companies to come into areas where there are protections for the water and land resources that those companies are dependent upon. We, in the national campaign, we have the unhappy task of going around the country to the places where major public health disasters have occurred. I travel from cancer cluster to birth defect cluster, particularly in the western United States. Some examples are Rockwell International contaminating community water supplies with plutonium northwest of Denver, Martin Marietta dumping rocket fuel knowingly into a municipal water supply. Major public health disasters have occurred. I travel from cancer cluster to birth defect cluster, particularly in the western United States. Some examples are Rockwell International contaminating community water supplies with plutonium northwest of Denver, Martin Marietta dumping rocket fuel knowingly into a municipal water supply again in Denver. I've just been in Oklahoma, where in a community called Ponca City, where there are hundreds of homes that have been affected by toxic sludge pouring into people's basements, literally wicking up the walls and dripping from the ceilings. Now, what happens in situations like that is that the economy is very adversely affected, on top of the very serious public health disasters that are occurring, leukemia cases, children with brain tumors by the age of 1 year old, et cetera. I can go on and on about the terrible kinds of consequences of hazardous waste once it has gotten out of control. And yet, looking more broadly at the whole economic picture, we see whole communities are beginning to die from the economic consequences of these problems not being abated early. The importance of passing this type of legislation is it will give the state of Alaska the ability to recover costs for doing early, rapid cleanups of hazardous waste spills and releases when they have occurred. And hazardous waste, unfortunately, is not like fine wine. It does not improve with age, and it becomes very much more expensive to clean up once it has gotten out into the environment and has affected municipal or private water supplies, et cetera. So it's very important to have a mechanism in place to be able to identify the party that's responsible and recover the cost from that party as promptly as possible. We also think it's very important that the state take a very strong stand on the strict liability for these substances, because the very nature of the fact that they are highly toxic in many cases and ultra-hazardous, they should be properly contained so that They will not be released into the environment. There is not the opportunity for them to spill or leak. They cannot be turned over by wind, fire, or destroyed in fires, etc. So we really do want to be promoting the safest possible technologies and encouraging the safest possible contractors to be dealing with these types of waste. And we think this bill does give that type of a hammer to the state to be setting those types of policies. I do have one concern about the bill, and that would be on page 2, line 23, subsection C. And that is where you are allowing the release from liability in cases that involve what is termed here as an act of God. I would think that you may not want to be quite that expansive in that particular section, because that could, any type of a rainstorm could be construed as an act of God. And again, I think we want to see the management of hazardous waste in such a way that weather conditions, earthquake conditions, whatever the typical local situation could possibly present, that any of those contingencies be arranged for and prevented. So I would encourage the committee to take a look at that again. I did testify in November to the House Committee about that particular concern as well, and would hope that the Senate would re-examine that particular exemption. So in total, we are very much in support of this bill and do think it will be a cost-effective bill over time to help encourage the best possible hazardous waste management and protect local communities from the economic and public health devastation of uncontrolled hazardous waste problems. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Anderson. Was Cordova still on the line?